Well, hello and welcome.
Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. Serge Borso, the CEO of a leading information security consulting organization known as SpiderSec. They're based in Denver, Colorado. Serge, thanks for your time, and let's go and get started, please.
All right, great. I'm happy to be here. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for your time. Well, looking at your bio, you seem to have a very deep and rich background in cybersecurity. Can you tell us some of the highlights of your career?
Sure. So I have been doing what I do for about a little over 15 years now. And back when I started, it was called information security, not cybersecurity. That's when,
okay.
I think Edward Snowden. Yeah, I mean, FBI and the whole government sector and, it becoming it meaning breaches, data breaches and attacks and, all the China, Russia, that type of stuff in the news. And then everyone's cybersecurity. Well, back in my day, it was just information security. So I think a lot of people who've been in this game a long time also kind of chuckle and say, oh, it's all of us learning about cyber. It's like, no, man, it's information security. But whatever. That's just something that they call
right.
me here. And I, to this day, I hear that all the time. Anyway, some of the highlights, it was some fun times. I've broken a lot of things, quite frankly. And that's really one of the best ways I've learned about how to help companies become more secure. It's by breaking things, believe it or not. So I don't know if I call those highlights, but I can think of a few times where, one of the first big ones that I'd actually brought down a whole network. And maybe this isn't the best way to start the podcast off with talking about how I broke things, but I was in a data center and I had to move some servers around. And I go to open the back of the cabinet, back of the rack to, pull out a server. And my shoulder just bumped into this power cable and it fell out of the back of a different server. And it took down a large portion of our client's ability to access our infrastructure, to put it nicely.
Oh,
and
wow.
That was it. I just jostled the cable. Yeah. And it was significant.
Well, it's one cable.
Because one cable, one power cable. and then after that, it's all about redundancy. Why do you only have one power cable if it's that important of a machine that has to be running all the time? And of course, it's my bad. It's totally my responsibility. I screwed up. But at the same token, it's like, okay, let's get that dual power supply. Then let's get a little twisty tie or a zip tie in there to make sure it doesn't come loose if someone jostles it, because it's that important of a machine. And it's like, that was an important thing that stuck with me over all these years. I've broken many things over my years, but that one kind of stuck out because it was one of those lessons learned. And it's like, how can we do this a little bit better? And it was interesting to me because things changed after that. There's actually motivation to, like I said, get a zip tie and get dual power supplies on there. And we have all the keys in the cabinets. Now we locked them all by default because of my stupidity.
Right.
But at the same token, I mean, it's a lesson learned type of thing. And in reality, things changed because of it to help secure physically that environment a little bit better.
Okay.
No.
So are there other highlights?
I don't know if that really answers. Good question. Other highlights, because that wasn't really a highlight. That was like me breaking something. highlights.
That's what pen test does, right?
Yeah, that's right. Do a lot of penetration testing. So I guess it goes hand in hand with that. That was I wouldn't call that a physical pen test, but it certainly shed some light on physical security. I guess more to really answer the question, the highlight I'm thinking, during penetration testing, gaining access to an environment from the outside in, and obviously I can't drop any names of the companies or clients or anything. I've got confidentiality, but having that first time where you're on the outside of the network, you're on the internet, and you have a target organization, so you have, a website and some servers and some services that are running on that network, and being able to find a flaw remotely and then exploit that flaw to gain access to that server, and then all of a sudden I'm behind the firewall. And being inside of their network, either intranet, being able to gain access to, other servers, pivoting, lateral movement, and so on. That was a highlight for me, where it was It was less about theory and less about all the stuff I learned, and more about putting it into practice and thinking, you know, taking a step back and realizing, okay, I'm a good guy. I'm getting paid to do this. I have a contract, but someone else could have easily done this for nefarious purposes and been malicious about it. And for me, that was a big highlight in my career, because as a penetration tester, that's really what you're trying to accomplish, is finding the flaw that's going to enable you to gain some privilege or access. And then ideally take that back to your client and tell them how you did it and how it can be fixed to help tighten their security posture. So that, and examples like that are really some of the highlights that I think back to of, wow, I've kind of come a long way from learning about it and doing it, practicing, and now it's for real. And I'm actually providing value to a business because of it.
Excellent. Okay. Now, how did you venture to SpiderSec?
I'm sorry?
How did you venture into SpiderSec?
How did I venture into SpiderSec? Well, it happened over the course of about the last 5 years or so. And as I mentioned, I've been doing this for maybe about a little over 15 years. And, you know, I started off doing, you know, network and system security and application security and penetration testing and so on and so forth. You add all that together and, you know, you get to a point 10 years into it and you're like, you know what, I love what I do. This is a great career path. I'm enjoying what I'm doing. And it's one of those type of things where there's some old saying where if you love what you do, you never have to work a day in your life. And that's kind of the place I found myself at, where I kind of hit my stride and really was enjoying every day. Going into work, it was fun. It was exciting. I was learning new things, and I was enjoying doing it. So from there, I mean, at the 10-year mark, I'm like, you know what? I love what I do. I should think about going ahead and doing it for myself, because I have a natural entrepreneurial spirit anyway, and I always thought of myself as an entrepreneur. And it was just a natural fit, you know. It's just what I love what I do. So let's go ahead and do it for myself and put those two passions together to create something. And that's really the advent of SpiderSec about 5 years ago is when I started the company. And that's, it came from there. And it was just the reality of, you know, wanting to try to help other businesses become more secure. And like I said before, you hear about these things in the news, you know, different countries and threat actors trying to gain access to businesses. It's like, well, what can I do to help my country and do my part to help lock down the security of different organizations? And that's kind of where this came from.
Excellent. Now, how big is SpiderSec? I mean, is it, can you get into a little bit more detail about that? Like, how long it's been in business and how big is your organization?
Sure. So we've been in business for about 5 years now, and we're small. We're based in Denver, Colorado. It's only me. I have a partner that kind of started this off with. He's more of a silent partner nowadays. And just a few contractors, depending on the engagement, meaning if we have a large workload or a big, you know, Fortune 500 customer, which we've had several of over the years, and there's a large quantity of work that needs to be done. I can't handle it all by myself. So I'll rely on folks I've met and worked with over the years to have them come in contract for SpiderSec to help with the penetration testing engagement or the engagement as the case may be. So like I said, we're small and we try to do the best we possibly can.
Now, who is your typical client? I mean, what do they do? Or is it the small, medium-sized business, the mom-and-pop stores, the Fortune 500, or perhaps even a combination of both? Because I think really any organization could use a good pen test, right? It doesn't matter whether it's a three-employee business or, you know, 10,000-employee business. I think really just about any company could use penetration testing.
You're exactly right. That's just kind of the reality of it. Depending on what the company does, they may have a real need for some type of penetration testing service. Our sweet spot is kind of the medium-sized business. And really, the reality of it is what drives the need for a customer to do a penetration test is typically, not always, but typically it's going to be some audit-driven type of motivation, meaning they're handling credit cards. So they're falling underneath the regulations of PCI. Therefore, they're required to do, an annual or biannual penetration testing. Other than that, we're talking, HIPAA, HITRUST, those type of businesses in that space that have a requirement are usually prime candidates for our customers right there. And that's usually where a lot of our business comes from. Now, what size are they? Like I said, medium-sized businesses typically. We've done several Fortune 500s over the years. So we get, big and medium. Not too many small companies. Some of them, you'll end up with a situation where they're maybe a startup. We've done plenty of startups over the 5 year span we've been in business. And you'll see a lot of companies also, and it's not just that audit requirement, it's that's driving the need for a penetration test. It's actually the desire to, try to be secure. And they don't necessarily have to do it. They kind of want to do it. And we're happy, obviously, to work with anyone who wants to have a penetration test done or anybody who's really serious about security. It's great to work with any organization like that. But yeah, that's the majority of it is the medium to larger size organizations that have the budget and the need or the want to do some penetration testing. Because here's the reality of it. For a penetration test, you look at your top 20 critical controls for security and you rank them from 1 to 20. Penetration testing is number 20. It's like the least important one. Maybe not, I shouldn't say least important, but I should say you should have 19 other more critical controls in place before you even do your penetration test. So there's a lot of stuff that has to go into securing an organization before you start thinking about, well, how can we have, think about someone breaking in and fixing all these flaws. It should be more of, you've already done a lot of the other security-focused objectives before you even start thinking about penetration tests. So usually we're talking about organizations that are a little bit more mature in their security process and program.
Okay, sounds great. Now let's get into your service line. It looks like SpiderSec has distinct service lines in three areas. One, obviously, being penetration testing, security awareness training. I know that you're a top-notch trainer in like for CFP, training students for taking that cert and discovery services. Can you tell us more about these in more detail?
Sure. So with penetration testing, we perform network penetration testing, mobile penetration testing, web application penetration testing, wireless pen testing, and physical pen testing. And it may be obvious to a lot of folks listening to this that what all those are. And for a lot of people listening to this, it's like, okay, you do penetration testing, what does it actually mean? So let me go ahead and break that down with some more background on each one of those. What it really means is they're all variations of the same thing. As a penetration test, or when doing a penetration test, the objective, of course, is to find a way to gain access or otherwise identify vulnerabilities that can be exploited to gain access to a network, if it's a network, or a mobile app, if it's an application, or a web application, if it's a web app, and so on and so forth. And really, what we're trying to do here is identify risk. And what I mean by that is there's a significant difference between running a vulnerability scan and doing a penetration test. And a great example of that would be instead of configuring a few IP addresses or, a large set of IP addresses and clicking a few buttons and running a scan and getting a report and showing vulnerabilities, a penetration test is much more manual, number one, and much more focused on what you can do with those vulnerabilities once they're identified. So specifically, a vulnerability scanning tool will find a flaw and then not exploit it or say, okay, here's some potential risk you might want to go look into. With a penetration test, it's we found some risk. Let's go ahead and exploit that to figure out what the true underlying risk of exploitation is or would be. And that's the main difference. I mean, you're using manual techniques to identify a flaw and exploit that flaw, and then like I said earlier, from the example of, gaining access from the internet to the intranet, now it's like, okay, I'm on your internal system, internal network. What can I gain access to now? And that's really where this whole threat modeling and risk-based approach comes into play, and that's the main difference. But you asked more about the kind of service line, and it's the same concept there for, like I said, either your wireless network or your physical network or your physical building. You know, we've had engagements where we're actually contracted to physically try to gain access to a building or a data center or the front door. And for that, you know, I had a good friend who was working with me on one of these physical penetration tests, and he's like, "Oh, I'm gonna bring my grappling hook. I'm gonna bring my taser. I was like, "No, man, let's take a step back and make sure we're understanding the scope of what we're trying to accomplish here." And but that brings to light this kind of reality of, yeah, we're trying to physically break into a building, of course, with permission and a contract in place. But that's what we do. And like I said, it could be for your mobile app that you're newly creating for whatever purpose, or maybe you update your mobile app. You want to have it tested because it handles PCI data or whatever the case may be. Or it could be a lot of it is web application penetration testing, or like I said, network, wireless network, or physical. Those are the five main things that we do for penetration testing. Now I'll move on and talk about the awareness training component, and that really is focused on phishing as a main component of that. And what we do for the phishing component is actually work with the company to send out phishing emails. And we have dozens of templates that can be chosen from, and the business will say, okay, we'd like to go with these few templates, and we do the like link-based or attachment-based phishing. And what that really kind of boils down to is, once the client has determined what they like to have for their phishing campaigns, we go ahead and configure our tool set to launch the campaign, which is basically a phishing email out to the intended recipients of that email. And then when someone clicks on that link, we track it. Pretty straightforward if it's just for security awareness training. So when someone clicks that link, we get that hit on the landing page of our web server. We can track uniquely who clicked on it, and then we can create the report or automatically generate the report showing who clicked it, who ignored it, and who escalated it based on kind of our partnership there with the organization we're working with. So we can track all those components, give the business a detailed report showing progress over time, and that's really the big takeaway from our awareness training, is the metric-based approach. Now, there's more to it than phishing. Of course, we don't just do phishing, but that is probably the more popular service offering we have for awareness training. The other component of that is the actual security training, where we'll go in to an organization. It's usually myself, and I'll speak to the associates or employees of that company and talk to them on a variety of topics depending on what the business would like to have discussed. This could be all-day training, could be multi-day training, or could be, you know, 90 minutes worth of training, depending what the business needs or wants. And then from there, we'll talk about essentially, you know, how to watch out for phishing emails, for example, or how to watch out for, you know, malicious attacks or tailgating or web browsing or whatever the case may be, ransomware, those type of concepts. And we'll break it down. And we have plenty of training material already designed and developed, and we can obviously create new stuff if there's a need or want for something different than what we already offer. And that's the big pieces of the security awareness training service that we offer. The last component of what we do is actually called Espiel. And what that really comes down to is a discovery-based service. So those are and I'll talk about that here in more just a second, but those are really the three things: penetration testing, security training, whether it's awareness training or physically on-site training people, and then Espiel. And that's it. We're not trying to be all things to all customers. We're not trying to offer this huge product and service array. It's just, we know what we'd like to do. We know what we're really good at doing, and we know we can provide the absolute best quality results with the service offering. So that's what we focus in on.
Excellent. So that's wonderful. Now, obviously, you know, Serge, there's a lot of penetration testing firms, you know, everywhere, you know, the Bay Area, you know, East Coast, and what have you. Why should a customer come to you and say, "Hey, Serge, I want you to pen test my company," as opposed to going to these other maybe hundreds of other pen testers? Excuse me. In other words, what makes you different from the other pen testers out there?
Right, that's a very fair question, and you'd think I'd have like an elevator pitch down to answer that right off the top of my head. And sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But the reality is, there's a lot of very talented individuals out there that perform penetration testing, and they work for sometimes themselves, sometimes for larger organizations. And I know a lot of them. I know there's a lot of really talented, smart people out there. The difference, I would say, are probably not a whole lot. Quite frankly, when you're working with a company who, or I should say that, is really good at what they do, that's kind of the level of expectations we're going to set. And I think that might be one of the differentiators right there, that the word expectations, and kind of this partnership approach that we take. So it's less of a let's go in and do a gig and move on, and more of a I want to work with you, understand your organization, take the time to know the people, the processes, the tools, your customers, how you make money, where your pain points are, where your risks are, where your exposures might be, and then build up on that over time, with that partnership where it's not just oh, let's do a gig and move on, and more of a I want to kind of be here for the long term. And that could just be the main difference right there, frankly. And the quality is obviously there. I mean, I've been doing this for 15 years. I've just wrote a book on web application penetration testing. I'm
Oh,
an
cool,
instructor with the
really?
SANS Institute. Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, you're getting high quality results and high quality services at SpiderSec, top notch, absolutely top notch. And our repeat customers, I think, would tell you, and it kind of set in place the story of how good our service actually is, because if it's crap, who's going to sign the contract for next year, type of thing. And that's majority of our business is repeat clients, so that speaks for itself. But as far as differentiators go, we're smaller, and that's good and bad in a lot of different ways. The main one, a bigger customer is going to give you like an account manager. They're going to have maybe a dedicated penetration tester, and they're going to have a couple different executive level people and maybe some technical writers, and get like six people dedicated to your project. You pay for that, period. And that's 20, 30, 40% markup on what our price is going to cost you. You get the exact same quality of service with SpiderSec, because obviously myself and the people on my team are very highly skilled and well trained. So the same quality of service, if not arguably maybe more SpiderSec, but you get it for a cheaper price. Okay, that's kind of the reality of it. We don't have that overhead. I don't have a dedicated account manager for you. I don't have a technical writer, and it's just not how we operate. And we also are not trying to sell, QSA services, and I'm not trying to sell, all these other products and services, and do the whole this whole onslaught of, cybersecurity services for your organization. We do these few things. We do them really, really well, and that's our focus, and that's kind of our differentiator right there.
Okay, excellent. So tell us about the security awareness training. What's that service look like?
So a little bit more on the security awareness training. As I mentioned, we'll do either the phishing component, which is by far the most popular one that we do, and that's kind of just to elaborate on that. We have templates. You choose a template, and we'll send that off. And now with that, the difference there that I didn't mention before was we don't just do that for security awareness training. We also do that for part of penetration testing, where it's less of a regular phishing campaign and more of a spear phishing campaign, a targeted attack against an organization where we're actually trying to get credentials. So we'll send a very legitimate looking email to a group of individuals, and then when they click on the link, they go to a website, they type in their credentials, and all of a sudden we have them. Or it could be, like I said, an attachment-based campaign where there's actually a semi-malicious attachment included in the email. We trick the individual into clicking that attachment and opening it up, hopefully, and getting shell access that way. But back to kind of awareness training component. This can be more of the, you know, phishing or on-site training. And the on-site training will actually go on-site to a business. We'll travel across the United States to do this type of training. And what we've done in the past is really hands-on immersion-typed training. And what that specifically looks like is we have, obviously, topics that we want to cover, and then we delve into, okay, let's talk about it for a little bit, give you some background information on it, and then from there, we actually have individuals in the class go ahead and do labs. So it's type of training where, you know, you need to have your laptop and you need to have some type of hopefully knowledge of what we're talking about, and then we fill in some blanks and then let you go forward and conquer. And I've done training like that for SANS. Obviously, I do training like that for OWASP as well. And it's the same concept of hands-on training with just talking about what we want to cover and then going ahead and doing it hands-on and then going through kind of the lab together so we're getting a clear understanding of what the takeaways are. And then the last form of training is going to be where we'll go on site for maybe just like 60 or 90 minutes or a couple hours, and we'll just talk about a few different topics. And that usually is to satisfy some type of requirement for annual training or something along those lines. There's other times where businesses actually want it done for different reasons. They just want to make sure they're up to date, or they got hit with a ransomware attack and they want to make sure people are well aware of kind of how it works. Maybe not the detailed information, because not a lot of employees would understand that, but more of a, here's how it can happen. Here's what happens when ransomware is triggered, for lack of better words. And this is the impact that it could have on the business. So we'll talk about kind of the risk associated with it and the attack vectors and how to, you know, watch out for those type of things. And the kind of the takeaway that it's not really a technology-only solution. It really is social engineering. It really is the human element that has to be focused in on. Otherwise, you're going to probably falling victim to a ransomware attack or some other type of malware attack. And that's kind of the main security awareness training components that we have for SpiderSec. It's going to be those three things, and they've become quite successful over the years. People seem to really like them.
Okay, excellent. Now, tell us more about SPL. This is different and seems kind of unique. Can you elaborate more on this, please?
Sure. SPL is the third and final service offering that we have. So we have the penetration testing, awareness training, or security training, and then SPL, ESPIAL. And that is trademarked for SpiderSec, and it's specifically a discovery service, meaning it's not a vulnerability scan. It's not some automated tool that finds flaws in your organization per se. It's more of a discovery. And kind of to get some background information on this, it's really going to be tuned more towards large enterprises. And the kind of background for this was me working at a couple of large businesses. So I worked for this one enterprise. We had maybe 100, 200 different domain names. And we had 5, 6 business segments. And then those business segments had acquired over the years another dozen or so businesses. So, you know, a few different main business segments. So you have enterprise and business segments underneath that, and then companies underneath that. So you're talking like a conglomerate of businesses and companies and domain names and websites and IP addresses. And it's like, whoa, how do we keep track of all this? And this is me working in-house at the enterprise security level for this organization. And it's like, seriously, how do we keep track of all this stuff? So we had a tool that we purchased from a third-party company. We're using this tool to do, they call it discovery scanning. And this discovery scanning tool did kind of a rudimentary identification of websites and IP addresses and things like that, like reverse DNS lookups and pointers and things like that. And that's where my idea came from, is really how could I automate this to make it more efficient and then put it into a database and then track this over time. Like, hey, this month we had 5 new domain names that popped up, and next month, oh, we have a loss of 15 for some reason, or we have these other ports that are listening, or whatever the case may be. We had a slash 20, so 4,096 IP addresses, public facing for this organization. That's a lot. That's, you know, 4,000 IPs you got to keep track of, plus all the different domains that were hosted somewhere else, like in AWS or Azure. So it became quite an effort to keep track of all this stuff. And as I was thinking about this, you know, later on, after I moved on to SpiderSec, I'm thinking, okay, this could be useful for large enterprises. How would I go about doing the same thing, or how could I offer a solution that's going to keep track of all of their disparate systems? And that's a real concern. I mean, when you get to the point of being a huge company that has all those IP addresses and all the different companies that you've purchased over the years, it's really difficult sometimes to keep track of all of it, especially if you have a management structure that doesn't really allow you to keep it all contained. And it's like, yeah, go ahead and use AWS. Go ahead and use this other cloud hosting provider. Go ahead and use GoDaddy. Go ahead. And, you know, it's like, okay, that might work for the business, but how does that work for security? How do we keep track of all this stuff? Because we're ultimately responsible for securing it. And I think that's really the crux of where Espial came from. It was that need for keeping track of all of these different systems. So what Espial does is you input your IP space and your domain names, and it goes and tries to extract and find other systems that you may not know about, or maybe you forgot about, or maybe there's some DNS zone transfer flaw, or you're missing some headers on the web server, or you have a domain, and on that domain, you've somewhere, you know, it's maybe that you have subdomains and so on and so forth, and you've uploaded PDFs and Excel spreadsheets and Word documents over the years, and this tool is going to go ahead and download those, and it's going to go ahead and parse those out, look for metadata, and try to find potentially domain usernames. It's going to look for other sensitive information like that. So it really discovers content, it discovers domains, it discovers IP addresses, it discovers things that maybe you've forgotten about over the years as a huge company who's purchased other companies, and it reports back to you everything that it finds in a manageable way. And that's really the premise behind Espial, is the discovery tool to help find those type of things.
Excellent. Now, we know that, you know, smartphones, mobile security is like a very hot button issue topic these days. You know, our smartphones become kind of like an extension of our personal lives, really, both personal and professional. Do you do anything for mobile security, like for the Android and the iOS and Windows platforms?
No, not specifically. I think Windows Phone is gone now. I was kind of looking forward to that becoming something more than what it ever did, just to have a little bit more diversity out there in the market. But it is all Android mostly, and some iOS as well. What we do in that realm, of course, is penetration testing. It's less platform specific, and what I mean by that is we're not going to like go ahead and assess the Android or iOS operating system itself. We're going to assess the security of the app that's installed on that device, and look for artifacts. You look for, you know, sensitive information left behind. Look for, you know, static keys. Look for, there's a whole OWASP list for mobile application penetration testing. We'll go through all that as well. But essentially, we're going to interact with it meaning the mobile application, in such a way to try to find flaws with it, just like we would for web application penetration testing. But outside of that, we don't develop any specific products or tools for mobile apps specifically.
Okay. Now, how about for companies that are dealing with all these crazy compliance rules and regulations like HIPAA, PCI, HITRUST, GDPR? Do you help them in any way?
Definitely. Absolutely. And the way we do it is just going back to our service offering. We're not trying to be all things to all people. We don't have internal auditors. We're not going to help you, you know, with your technical writing or things like that. It's going to be penetration testing. And for all of those that you mentioned, PCI, HIPAA, HITRUST, and others, there is a requirement for usually an annual penetration test. And that's where we go in and provide our service to help with that. Now, as a seasoned penetration tester, and same thing with the people on my team, here at SpiderSec, that's what we do. We do it day in and day out. We offer penetration testing services. And what that means is it's transferable, specifically whether it's PCI, HIPAA, or iTrust, or others like that. It's like kind of the nice thing about penetration testing is it doesn't matter so much about what industry you're in. The general methodology we're going to follow is essentially the same. So I don't really care if you have credit cards or health records. The way I'm going to go about trying to compromise your assets is pretty much the same way, regardless of what industry you're in. The differences are going to be now I'm looking for, you know, a 16-digit number, depending on what type of credit cards are in your environment, or I'm looking for, you know, SSNs or, you know, publicly identifiable information, personally identifiable information, so on and so forth, depending on that specific engagement. But that goes back to what I said, you know, 30 minutes or so ago, where one of our differentiators at SpiderSec compared to, you know, our competition is we have the ability to take that time and learn about your business. So we're going to ask you probing questions, you know, like what are the keys to the kingdom? What are the crown jewels? If something bad were to happen, how would you recover from that? Or what is an instance of something bad that could happen that you're concerned about? And take the time to understand the business and their pain points so we can craft a suitable penetration test that's going to be tailored to that company. While, like I said, the methodology will be the same regardless of kind of who we're working with, it's going to be, well, now we're looking in this certain area, or now we're going to focus much more on your segmentation testing because of X, Y, and Z. And taking that background information that the business has given us, we can really delve into the penetration test with a different set of eyes, if you will.
Excellent. Now, can you tell us more about ASV scanning, and what is that, and is that something that you actually do with SpiderSec?
So ASV scanning, so this is going to be for PCI. That's your authorized scanning vendor. And what that is a service that some companies offer. SpiderSec does not do that. We don't do any ASV scanning. And what that is specifically is a means by which a company will run a tool like Nessus or Nexpose or Qualys or something like that, a tool like that, on a regular basis to scan their environment, specifically their PCI assets. And they need to run that scan at least once a quarter until they get passing results. Passing meaning the tool typically is uncredentialed, unauthorized scan. Is going to go and scan whatever IP addresses they tell it to scan that are in scope for PCI. It's going to come back with some findings. If they're high or medium risk, typically they need to be fixed and then scanned again until all the IP addresses that are in scope come back with passing green, no high, no medium risk vulnerabilities. And that's how you get a passing result for PCI on a quarterly basis, which is a requirement of PCI compliance. And that is ASV scanning. And that's not something that we offer. Typically, or I shouldn't say typically, it's not something we offer because it's not necessarily a business segment we want to get into right now. There's plenty of other people that do that. They have mature tools. And not to say that we couldn't come in and do the exact same thing and do it better. We probably could, but it's not a focus for us right now.
Okay. Now, do you have any customer success stories that you can share with us?
Yes and no. Yes, plenty of customer success stories. No, none that we can share because of confidentiality agreements that are in place. So we don't talk about our customers by name, and they don't typically talk about us by name. We don't usually – actually, I don't think we've ever asked for like a case study or anything like that. We don't put logos on our website. You go to our website, it's like, oh, here's our customers. Here's our Fortune 500s we've done work with. Here's all the PCI customers. Here's our HIPAA customers. And here's a case study. And we don't do any of that. We don't do that for marketing. We don't do that for anything. It's confidential. And same thing with them. When they get a penetration test report from us and they pass, we don't give them a seal of approval and say, hey, stick this on your website. No, that's not how we operate at all. And the big thing behind that is, you know, it's confidentiality, number one. We don't want to go ahead and tell who all of our customers are. And we do that for a couple different reasons. The other one is you got to think about the attacker's perspective. And we don't want to make our customers maybe more of a target than they already are. And what I mean by that is when you have the seal of approval, sometimes attackers can kind of take that as a challenge and say, oh, so you think you're strong. Or maybe they have a vendetta against me personally, and it's not too hard. You do a Google search Borso, and SpiderSec pops up. Like, oh, I know Serge. He taught me in class, and I think he's an idiot. I want to get back at him, so I want to make him look bad. So what are they going to do? They could attack me, they could attack my company, and then they could attack my customers. That's a step too far. You know, if you want to attack me and my business, that's one thing. We need to be strong enough to, you know, make sure we're locking our stuff down. But now you're going to attack our customers and just to try to make us look bad. It's hypothetical, of course. I'm not saying this has happened or would happen or will happen, but it's one of those type of things we don't want to, set something up like that so it could happen. So err on the side of caution from that perspective, and those are the reasons
why. Well, that's
why.
Good. I mean, that's good. You know, I mean, you're really protecting your customers. That's what's important. Well, do you have any failed stories you can tell us? Have you been successful in your engagements, or have there been some cases in which you just could not do something that the customer wanted? Or
we've failed. I've personally failed many times, many times over the years, and not just at my own company doing penetration tests. I never really had like a failed penetration test per se, but the story I gave, I unplugged that server one time. That was significant. There was another time I was working for a company, and I had way too much privileged access on the network. I had root access on like a main production SQL server, and I opened up the SQL command line, and it ran a query, and it locked up the whole database so no other queries could run until mine finished. And it just happened to be on the production most important server in the entire company. I was such an idiot. And that caused an outage for the duration of my query. That sucked. So things like that. With SpiderSec specifically, though, not so much. Yeah, definitely, but not to that causing an outage level. Remember one of the first engagements that I did, it was a web app and API penetration test. So they had an API, and they're still around today. They're still a great entity to work with, and they're here in the Denver area. And what had happened was we were trying to do a username harvesting or account enumeration exploit. And the way to trigger the certain condition to identify valid users was to do a password reset. And if you typed in like a username or an email address in this input box in the form on the website, it would trigger a password reset email to be sent out and tell you. And that distinction was it told you, yes, the email's been sent, or no customer with that email address found, or something along those lines. And throughout the course of penetration testing, it's like, well, if I can gain access to a customer's account, has a weak password or a default password or something along those lines, it could be of value to the penetration test. So I automated an attack that would ultimately identify valid usernames and accounts, but to do so, to reiterate, it would trigger a password reset email. So throughout the course of testing, it's like, okay, I'll go ahead and do this. Didn't really think through the implications of this very well. And this happened to be, just for some background information, a type of business that had their customers like on their homepage. I say, we work with all these different customers. You know, it's kind of like we were just talking about 5 minutes ago. SpiderSec doesn't do that. Other companies do. They say, these are our customers, and they want to promote that. Well, from there, it's like, okay, I'll go to LinkedIn, and I'll go to do some Google searches. I'll do some type of, OSINT, open source intelligence gathering, and try to find some email addresses for these users and what they might have used for an account on this primary web application I'm testing. Anyway, long story short, I went ahead and automated that attack and found a bunch of different usernames, but at the cost of triggering all those password reset emails. So what that ended up doing was, resetting a bunch of legitimate customers' email or accounts, passwords, resetting it, or sending it out the email address, password reset email. And the way where it came from, of course, was the customer I was testing. And I had to do some damage control, had to, you know, give them clear. They said, oh, crap, by the way, this, and I should have known before I did it. It was a really stupid thing for me to do, but anyway, that's what happened, and triggered a bunch of email reset passwords to go out, or password reset emails to go out, rather, and kind of freaked out their customer base, and it was a really stupid thing to do, but you live and learn type of thing. So that was definitely an interesting fail that has stuck with me over the years.
Well,
yeah,
no,
could have been worse, but yeah.
Well, do you have any other stories you want to tell us, or...
Well, so far I've told you all the fails.
Those okay.
Are
well, we don't want to make
sprinkling
now, right?
a success story.
Anyway, I'm just
yeah.
Anyway, so what's your take on APTs and state-sponsored attacks? I mean, we keep hearing about China, Russia, North Korea, blah blah blah. And so, what's your take on all that?
Yes, the advanced phishing threat is real. APT, yeah, advanced persistent threat. No, it's the advanced phishing. That's really, really comes down to. You read these case studies when we're privileged enough to actually have some detailed information about what happened, which is seems to be rare. You don't ever really get the usually don't get the inside scoop of what the root cause of a breach was. Like with Equifax, we figured out it was Struts, but I say we figured it out. You know, it's like where's the detailed write up on that? Where's the detailed write-up on X, Y, and Z? And all these companies that get compromised, they blame it on APT. And it's like, where's your detailed write-up? And why don't you share it publicly so we can all learn from your mistakes? How about that? That'd be great. But you don't typically get that. So when we do glean some information about an APT or a compromise that's happened, it's kind of left to the reader to guess about what the root cause was, or a leak, or a little bit of information that comes out of the organization. And a lot of times, quite frankly, it comes down to someone clicking on an email, someone falling victim to a phishing campaign. That's it. So that's why I jokingly said APT, the average phishing threat. That's really what it comes down to. So that's kind of my take on it. It's user training. It's awareness training, and that's, like I said, that's one of the big things that we do is a security awareness training, and phishing is one of our most popular things that we do because you can still trick a human to this day. I can still send an email. It's going to get past your filters, your spam filters, or your whatever, anti-malware filters that you have, and it's going to look real, and someone's going to click on it to this day. And why does that matter? It's because it's not a technology-only solution. You can't just buy your way out of that risk. You can't spend money on a tool and expect it to go away. So that's kind of my take on the APT. It's still coming down to this user awareness training component where people are still, I don't want to say the weakest link. I hear that way too often. It's like, oh, humans are the weakest link. Yeah, I don't know. But we as humans typically are going to be a threat vector or attack vector that can still be exploited to this day without just a paycheck or, I'm sorry, without just someone writing a check and buying more technology. So the human factor always plays into it. That's kind of my take. The APT stuff, it's usually not as advanced as the rest of the world thinks it is. And what I mean by that statement specifically is for those of us working in information security with the experience and knowledge, we know that it's not magic. This isn't really typically that advanced of a threat or that threat actor or, some unknown malware that has never been picked up. It's just threat actors relying on tried and true, typically, techniques to gain access or infiltrate a network and then go undetected. It's not typically overly complex. And, of course, it is very complex and hard to understand and very advanced to the people who don't really know the inner workings of IT and security. So for the layman out there watching the news, yeah, it's advanced. But for those of us who are in the industry, it's like, oh, yeah, we should have known better. We should have updated Apache struts, or we should have patched our systems in a timely fashion, or we should have so on and so forth. It's something that typically probably should have been caught and just wasn't because of X, Y, and Z. And I'm not going to get into more details on than that. That's kind of my two cents on this whole APT thing that you hear about from time to time.
Now, kind of going back to your bio, and you're a CISSP, and I think that's kind of like the golden bar in or one of the oldest and one of the most reputable certifications in cybersecurity. And you're a SANS instructor, so can you tell us what's that like, and how do you teach a CISSP course?
Okay, so with the CISSP, the Certified Information Systems Security Professional, that certification, I think it has clout to this day because, and I'm not really up to date with certs. I mean, as far as the new ones that come out and all the different breadth and depth of certificates, but I know this one requires 5 years of experience before you can even sit to take the exam, unless you have a degree or years of education, in which case you can sit for the exam after 4 years. And even then, I think there's a couple of other little loopholes where you can take the exam sooner than that. Maybe I could be wrong on that. I don't know. I did mine back in 2011, and I studied for it. By that point in time, I had whatever 15 minus 2019 right now, however many years that is of experience, and a degree. I had a couple degrees, I think, by the time I took that CISSP. And it was multiple domains of knowledge. You had to know about applications, you had to know about cryptography, you had to know about network security and system security and so on and so forth. So it was, like a mile wide, inch deep type of thing. But it did require you to have those years of experience, which is why I think it still has clout to this day. And because the other reality there is a lot of people have taken it, a lot of people have passed it, a lot of people struggled with it and failed many times, and they think it's generally, I think it's thought of as a, rite of passage, almost, if you will, like passing the bar before you can practice law. It's like you gotta kind of have that. For some positions, for some people, in some places, a lot of people don't have it. They're brilliant. They know way more than I do about a lot of things, and they don't have a CISSP or even a bachelor's degree. It's just not required necessarily in this industry. But with that being said, a lot of people do look to that CISSP as kind of a benchmark. Now, teaching for that, or how do I kind of get people prepared? I don't teach SANS for CISSP. I don't do any boot camp type of stuff, and it's not really one of the focus points that I have. I took it, I moved on, I maintain my CPEs, and I keep it up to date and pay my annual fees for it to never expire, because I wouldn't want to have to take it. It was kind of annoying. But as far as what I can speak to with the CISSP, it's once you've been in the game, or I said, I think it's the second time I said in the game, but once you've been in this profession for about 5 or so years, if you have enough knowledge and if you've done enough things, it should be kind of second nature. At least it was when I took it, to take that exam and pass it without too much effort. Because after 5 years, hopefully you've worked maybe one or two, three places or so, and you've done many different things. You've done a threat matrix, you've done physical security, you've been inside of a data center and unplugged a cable on a computer accidentally once, that type of stuff. And you learned some lessons and so on and so forth. But you had that experience to back it up, and then it should just be, it was for me. It seemed like it was just second nature to, oh yeah, this seems like a logical answer for this type of question, and it kind of all just comes together for you with that experience. As far as preparing for it, though, that's the best thing I can say is just get the experience. Get out there, work in the industry, and get exposed to multiple different things.
Okay, sounds excellent. Do you have any other certs, or is it the CISSP that you have?
Have the CISSP and then several SANS certifications. So I have a GPEN, which is penetration tester, the GWAPT, web application penetration tester. I have a G, GI, what is it? The GCFA, the Certified Forensic Analyst, and something else, I think. I don't know. It's a lot to keep track of, and then it was cool. When I was working for a company.
Right.
They'd pay for my upkeep of those. Now I got to pay for myself. I was like, how much of these do I really need? It's not, you know, it's something you got to take into account at some point in time. So I got a couple degrees. I have a master's degree in computer system security and the CISSP and all those other GIAC SANS certs and stuff like that.
Now, when you do the pen tests for your clients, and I'm sure they probably have friends that ask you the same thing, what advice do you give for SMB or the small and medium-sized business and even larger companies to protect themselves, to beef up their lines of defense? What are your tips that you normally tell them?
You look up the CIS, the Critical Information Controls, or whatever it is, Critical Information Security Controls. It used to be called the SANS Top 20. And that's your starting point. That should be your starting point. So number one, for example, on that list, in order of most important to least important, and I touched on this briefly before, is number one is physical inventory. Have a physical inventory of all of your different assets that you're responsible for, period. You can't protect what you don't know about. So if you, for instance, have servers or laptops or workstations or whatever it is at your company, and you're not aware that you even have those, how can you possibly protect those endpoints? The answer is you can't, really. If you're not scanning them, you're not patching them, you don't have up-to-date AV signatures on there, you don't have extra threat protection, you don't have, you know, so on and so forth, then how can you possibly protect those assets? And to reiterate, it's difficult to, you know, if you don't know what you have. So number one is do that. And then, of course, inventory of authorized and unauthorized software. So what software is allowed to run. And then the whole list from there down to number 20, which is penetration testing. So while a company may come to SpiderSec and say, we need a penetration test, we'll gladly oblige. We'll talk about kind of where they're at in their life cycle and maturity as far as, you know, security maturity goes. But with that, we'll say, well, what else can we potentially help you with? Or what else, kind of where are you at in the spectrum of security? And if, you know, they're not really familiar with that documentation or that framework I just mentioned, you know, we'll have a conversation about it and say, you know, this is a great starting point, and you can use this to keep track of everything that's going on in your world and then to really create a mature and robust security program for your organization. And then, of course, with that, there's going to be some penetration testing at some point if that that need is still there.
Okay. Now, what are your general plans for expansion for your company? Do you plan to offer new products, new services, new markets, or a combination of both, perhaps?
So what I want to do for expansion is probably continue focusing on the services that we offer today. They're rather mature, but there's always room for improvement. It's like writing software. You wrote this app, and you're done writing it. But that never really happens. You're never really done writing it. There's always a new version, a new release coming out. You know, that's just how it is with software. And I think the same thing holds true for our service offering here at SpiderSec, where there's always room for improvement, and the next version of whatever it is coming out, we can make it better and tune it, so to speak. So I don't want to add on more stuff and more services or more products per se. I just want to make sure that what we're offering continues to be top-notch and, quite frankly, maybe automate a little bit more of it and really focus in on some of the services that we can get some recurring revenue without having to put in all the manual effort. And for that, it would be Espial. You know, get some customers onboarded using that as kind of their go-to discovery scanning tool, and then keep on working on that to make it more efficient. And like I said, the automation is key for that type of stuff. So the expansion, I don't necessarily want to add more headcounts, or, you know, have venture capitalists come in and give us money or anything like that. I mean, we're profitable. SpiderSec has been profitable since day one. There's, you know, zero debt around here. And that's why I like to keep it. I don't want to bite off more than I can chew, so to speak, because I have a pretty full plate as it is, and I just want to, like I said, maintain and increase the quality of what we do today before I start worrying about or thinking about adding in new stuff. Now, with that being said, there's always kind of that need-based approach where we have a customer and they say, hey, do you guys do this? Well, no, we don't do that. Well, can you do it? It depends. I mean, if it falls in our wheelhouse of our expertise, then there's always an opportunity there to go ahead and then think about adding in another service, or at least kind of thinking about that approach to see if it would work in the long term for not just that one customer, but other customers as well. So that's kind of the way I look at it. There's no need to go crazy with anything that we do. Just want to take it one step at a time, play it cool, and ensure that we have the highest quality services that are available.
Sounds excellent. Now, how do you foresee the cyber threat landscape changing, evolving? I mean, it's changing like every day. You know, this is broken into, that's hacked into, all this PII has been stolen. How do you think this is going to change this year or next year? And what do you think is the big cyber threat's going to be? Ransomware, phishing, cryptojacking? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm usually crappy at answering these questions because I don't know. I'm not good at thinking what's going to happen in the future for some reason. Yeah, I'll give you – I don't see it changing so much, man. I'll probably be wrong. There's going to be something new that comes out, and I don't know what it is. How about that for an answer? I don't think phishing is going away. I don't think this cyber espionage or even this nation-state – threat actor component is going to go away at all either. I kind of see this modern warfare frontier being increasingly played out in cyberspace. And that may be obvious or redundant because someone else has already said that more eloquently than I just did. But I see that, and that's just the truth. I see instead of humans and boots on the ground and, you know, humans actually shooting and killing people, it's going to be more of a I'm going to launch this, you know, another Stuxnet type of thing. And now it's going to be from China coming into the U.S. And we're going to see more, you know, ICS type of attacks against our power grid or our refinement facilities we have here, or those type of attacks where you're not causing casualties per se of humans, but our systems are going to be offline and we're going to have some damage to our physical assets and our ability to have clean water or refine uranium or enrich uranium or other things that we depend on as humans in this country and other countries across the globe to have that and maintain that quality of living and the quality of life, or even with the elections and our freedom to have faith in the sanctity and security of our election process. That's not going to change, I don't think. And I think that's probably going to be the next big thing that comes up. We've already seen pieces of it, but I wouldn't rule out an increase in the upscale of those type of attacks. So it's less of I'm now going after the human capital, and I'm going after your systems and your assets virtually. And I think we'll see a lot more focus on that.
Okay. Now, we've talked about the corporate environment. What do you recommend for individuals to protect themselves and their environment from attackers?
Education and awareness. And I keep going back to that because to answer this question specifically, it's not about what are you going to buy. It's most people aren't really going to buy anything, I don't think, for their house. Some of the listeners of this podcast may be so inclined to do so, but for the general population out there, I don't think there's a huge market for going to Best Buy or Micro Center or Amazon or eBay or whatever it is and buying some device that's going to help keep your home network secure. I just don't see it. I don't see it as a motivation for people right now. So because of that, how are you going to keep your stuff secure? Well, education. You have to understand that you are being attacked. You are a target. And whether that's from a malicious app that you install or that your kid install on their phone, and that's now going to be on your internal wireless network at your house, or it's going to be, you know, you have a weak wireless password, or you have a default password on your modem or your router at home, or the IoT device that you install in your front door is now, once again, set with a default password, or it hasn't been patched, it's never going to be patched because the company you bought it from is no longer in business, and it has, you know, remotely executable, you know, a vulnerability that can be remotely exploited, those type of flaws. And people don't know about it. People have no idea that the IoT device or the teddy bear they just bought for their kid or the thermostat that's in their house is never going to be updated again, or it's already vulnerable. As soon as you took out the box, it was vulnerable, and it can be exploited. And this goes back to this menacing type of answer to the last question I gave, where I could see more of that happening, more of now we're going to have threat actors in other countries, or this country for that matter, that's going to be taking advantage of those type of flaws, which they already have. We had the whole botnet based on IoT devices that caused, you know, distributed denial of service attacks in the past couple of years, those type of things. But now it's going to be really investing time to figure out where they can make money off of this. So to go back to your answering your question, how are people, or what I recommend for people to do to really lock down their environment, with the education awareness components already mentioned, in addition to that, it's going to be really trying to implement some controls. And it could be something very simple, like changing passwords, changing default passwords on technology that you purchase, and employing decryption. If you have an iOS device, obviously it's already encrypted. Android, you can do this exact same thing. So when you leave your device behind, it's at least encrypted. And then, of course, password managers and password vaults. So you have the ability, with proper knowledge and training and know-how, to safely have a different, very unique, long and strong password for all the different websites you go to. And there's things like that people could do. But people aren't going to do that. Quite frankly, I don't believe people will do that. Number one, they're not going to want to spend the money on some things that cost money. Number two, they're not going to want to put the effort into being inconvenienced. Great example of that is two-factor authentication. You know, examples of what I'd tell people to help them become more secure, use two-factor authentication for your sensitive accounts. And who does that? People like you and I and people listening to this podcast. Other than that, not a whole lot of people are actually using two-factor authentication for the services. And because it's inconvenient, or they don't know, or they don't know how to set it up, or they're scared they're going to be locked out, or other plethora of reasons. So getting kind of past that is challenging for the layman out there. It just is not technically inclined, or they have no desire to really be concerned about it. And I think you see that with the culture of a lot of today's youth, where it's like, yeah, I'm just going to post all my personal information on Instagram and tweet about it and have it on my Facebook page anyway. So it's like, I don't really care what happens to my information. I think that the mentality, that type of mentality, is prevalent in a lot of different people. So taking the time to really educate yourself and lock things down, I don't really know how popular that's going to be. But that wasn't your question. Your question was, what would I recommend? And those are the things I recommend. You know, two-factor authentication, password vaults, and just education on how to use them to lock down your assets.
One, you touched on a subject that, you know, it's kind of intriguing. It's about IoT, and I think I'll put in artificial intelligence. What are your thoughts on IoT? Do you have an IoT environment near? You probably don't want to say it, but why, like, do you know if anybody has an IoT, like a smart home or anything like that? What are your thoughts on the Internet of Things and using AI and so forth?
So I do have friends that have kind of smartified their house. I think it's different terminology that's more accurate to describe it. But, yeah, they have, like, a smart house with a bunch of IoT devices, and they're all linked together from, like, opening the blinds in the morning to ordering cat food for their cat. And I see the allure of that, where it's you got the convenience factor, and it's kind of nice, and it's kind of this home automation that I can see becoming more popular. And me specifically, no, I don't do that type of stuff. That's not anything I kind of get down with. But a lot of people do, and like I said, our friends have done that. I have a couple different thoughts on it. I personally wouldn't be too comfortable with all that automation with vendors I don't necessarily trust or software I can't necessarily control and update. I don't know. I'm not sold on it. I don't know if the whole AI machine learning component is even there yet, or if you can even call anything that's truly AI at this point, or anything even close to that at this juncture in our life here in 2019. And because of that, maybe not because of it, but with that, I don't really see the whole selling point for all that stuff. Sure, it's convenient. Sure, it's kind of cool to automate your home and to have some of that stuff happen for you and make your life easier and more connected. I don't really see that as a huge motivation for me. And I've also been reading more and more about things lately where it's, you know, back in the day of the early web, you'd have people going onto the chat rooms to escape their everyday reality. And now you have people unplugging and going to the mountains for camping trips to escape their virtual lives. So I think we're maybe at a tipping point in this world that we live in where there's enough technology and there's enough devices living and encompassing our house and our world that we live in to where you just want to get away from it all sometimes and unplug. And I think that's probably more the side of the spectrum I fall on as far as IoT devices, automation, AI, and all that.
Okay. Well, as we start to wrap up our show, you talked about a book. In fact, while we were talking, I kind of looked you up on Amazon about your book. Tell us more about it, how you wrote it, what got inspired to write it, who published it, so forth. Give us all the details.
Sure. So what this came from is called Our Tech House Publishing. They're the publishing company. And an individual from that publishing company randomly reached out to me one day. And that's the reality of it. Like, I don't know who you are. I've never heard of your company before. The gentleman was inquisitive as to whether or not I would like to write a book. And I was busy. I'm a busy guy. Like, I'm always busy doing stuff. I work many hours, and I have a lot of work to get done. I'm like, well, okay, this is interesting. I can start in like 4 months from now. And he was like, okay, that's fine. Give me some ideas on what you might want to write about. They didn't come to me with the idea. They came to me with, hey, we know you're a science instructor, and this is your background, and you look like a pretty solid type of person. Different words were used, of course. And, you know, come up with an idea and shoot us back the idea if you think you might want to write a book. So I did. And I was thinking, you know, what do I know really well? And that's the thing. I mean, if you're going to write a book, in my opinion, you really got to know your stuff really, really well. So I'm thinking, okay, what do I really know the best? And that was probably web applications, so web application pen testing and that whole world. And so I'm thinking, okay, I'll pitch that idea of a book about web application penetration testing. But I need to have a different spin on it. What's really going to motivate people to buy it or to get value out of it? And I'm thinking, okay, I'll follow the OWASP top 10, the Open Web Application Security Project's top 10 most critical vulnerabilities. And there's 10 of them, obviously, OWASP top 10. And I'm thinking, okay, let's go through each one of those and talk about, you know, the details of what the flaw is. And then I'll talk about how to exploit the flaw. I'll give examples and like maybe even some hands-on lab type of stuff. And that was kind of my thought process. And I pitched that idea to the publishing company. And they liked it. I said, let's go with it. So, and you know, contract negotiations went back and forth, and I agreed to doing it. And then 4 months later or so, I started writing it. And it was quite a process. Writing a book is real. It was a significant amount of effort and time and dedication. And just the whole thing in the back of your head all the time, for me anyway, is like, is this going to be good enough? Are people going to like this? Are people going to get value out of this? So it's a constant push to make sure it's very high quality. Just like the same mentality I take into SpiderSec is I want to make sure the services we offer are super high quality and people are getting the best they possibly can. That way, you know, people feel like it's money well spent. And that's the same mentality I took into the book. And then, like I said, there's a lot of effort and time and hard work and editing. And I gotta say, the most annoying part about the whole book was probably having to write it and then format in such a way that it was going to be good for the publisher. It wasn't just writing a book, like, oh, I'm going to use Microsoft Word and write these paragraphs and it's going to be good. It's like, no, you have to. I had to format it using text, T-E-X, LaTeX, and get all the headers and the page numbers to line up and the images to line up just right, and redo the images like 100 different times to get them to line up exactly right. It's like, dude, am I writing a book or what's going on here? It was so annoying, but it was part of the process. Kind of nice to take that away and learn from that whole experience. So, yeah, I'm happy to say the Penetration Tester's Guide to Web Applications has been published. It's currently on sale right now, and it does come with complimentary lab access for anyone who's purchased the book. So hands-on labs, you go to your website, and you actually get to go through every single one of them.
Do you plan on writing more books in the future, or this is going to be it for you? Or?
Well, it makes sense to kind of keep up with the OWASP Top 10. OWASP releases that every 3 or 4 years or so. The latest one was actually 2017, so maybe 2020-ish, they might come out with a new list of the OWASP Top 10. That would kind of make sense for me to update the book at that point in time and cover the new Top 10 and keep it rolling.
Cool. Sounds awesome. Well, finally,
yeah.
I mean, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you? I bet you're a contact info on our landing page for your podcast. But are there any other ways you can get a hold of you? Or?
Yes. So my main kind of thing when I'm meeting people is going to be LinkedIn. And I'll, you know, say I'm on LinkedIn, link in with me. And I just recently started getting serious about Twitter. I've had the account for many years, but I don't really tweet very much. And I don't really use it as a communications method per se. But I am at Serge Borso or linkedin.com/Serge Borso. That's SergeBorso. And that's a great way to get in contact with me.
Okay. Well, Serge, we thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Thank you, and congratulations on your book once again and on a successful company. We hope to have you again.
I really appreciate your time. Thanks for putting this together. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye.